I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC, and this is the news.
How long have you guys been out here so far?
4 hours.
Long lines and ballot glitches for days. Voter overload, bureaucratic mismanagement, voter suppression. What's going on here? The plot thickens. Same group, different target. The plan to kidnap a second governor revealed in FBI testimony.
I'm not hostile to the ACA.
Healthcare, abortion rights, and racial justice.
It's a difficult one for us, like it is for Americans all over the country. You
know, Americans hear from Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Plus,
I definitely thought, like, yeah, I was going to get hurt.
The terrifying run-in a jogger had with this mountain lion. We speak with the man live tonight. And good evening. 3 weeks to the election now. Early voting happening at this moment in 46 states. Voter turnout continues to be record-shattering and in some cases overwhelming. Take a look at these long lines in Texas, where early in-person voting kicked off just today. And some people report they had to wait for hours to cast their ballot. Joe Biden spent the day in Florida with a focus on senior citizens and black voters. Right now, President Trump is set to speak at a campaign rally in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. It's one of his airport rallies where he flies in, speaks, and flies out on Air Force One. Nearly 12 million Americans have already voted. We've never seen numbers like this. Take Texas. Early voting comes on the heels of a federal appeals court ruling just yesterday that state can limit counties to just one drop-off spot. Just one per county. So what does that mean? Well, look at Harris County. Census figures show 4.7 million people live there. 26 states have a smaller population than that. Yet Harris County, like all the rest in Texas, has one drop box. It's at the arena where the Houston Texans play football. Dr. Jill Biden is hosting a Get Out the Vote rally there now. Priscilla Thompson in Houston. Priscilla, day one of early voting there. And really, how's it going?
Well, it has been a record-breaking day here, Shep. More than 117,000 people have cast ballots in Harris County. That is a record for any period of early voting in the county's history. And as you can see, that voting is still going on. You take a look over here, you can see that drive-in voting is still underway here in this parking lot. Folks are able to pull in and cast their ballot electronically and then, head on their way without ever having to get out of their car. And, you know, polls are closing in less than an hour, so things are beginning to wind down here. But you mentioned that absentee ballot drop-off location. This is it, right behind me. This is the one place in the county where folks are able to drop off those absentee ballots. There's been a steady stream of folks here today. We're in just under an hour until polls close, so it's slowed down a bit. But one of the key issues here is going to be in the coming weeks, whenever folks can no longer, the timeline is too tight to mail in those ballots, is this site going to become overwhelmed with people trying to drop them off in person? Shep?
Priscilla Thompson in Houston, now Georgia. Early voters casting, again, a record number of ballots. They did it after waiting for hours at many polling stations across the state. According to Georgia's Secretary of State, more than 126,000 people voted in person early on Monday. That's a 41% increase over the first day back in 2016. Local coverage now, WXIA's Hope Ford, live at a polling precinct in Duluth, just outside Atlanta. Hi, Hope.
Yeah, people in this line have been waiting for about 2 hours to vote, which is short in comparison to some of the wait times we have seen both yesterday and today. The polls actually just closed. That means all of these people right here will still get a chance to vote. But, people who are still showing up, as we see, there are a couple people still showing up. They will have to come back tomorrow. And we have seen that continuously throughout Georgia, those long wait times today. People came a little bit more prepared this time. They had chairs, they had books, they had umbrellas. People in a neighboring county, they started lining up at 4 a.m. to make sure they had a chance to do what they've really waited all year to do, which is vote. Now, we have still had some of those technical issues today that we saw also yesterday as well. So they've been technical issues. We actually also found out that people have been canceling their absentee ballots to show up to vote in person because they don't trust the mail-in process here in Georgia. And we just found out, we talked to the elections director in Gwinnett County, where we are right now, just a few minutes ago, and they told us that they are going to add more ballot marking stations to help alleviate some of these wait times. The wait time got up to 8 hours today in some parts. Do what they can by adding more.
Hope Ford with some technical issues of her own in Georgia. Well, today's the last day to register to vote in Virginia. But there were problems there, too, this time technical. Officials say somebody cut a cable this morning, and that shut down some state websites. They came back up this afternoon, but by then, Virginians were wanting more time to register and complaining. The thing is, there's nothing in the statute to allow for that. Again, this is all new and confusing, like everything COVID. Confusing and sometimes overwhelming, because record numbers of voters are trying to cast their ballots or in some way participate early. Lots of questions. Can the system handle it? Are there efforts to get in the way? Will voters trust the outcome? Let's turn to Larry Sabato. He is the director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Professor Sabato, good to see you and thank you.
Thank you, Shep.
A cut cable in Virginia, misprinted ballots in spots across the nation, some wrong names, some wrong addresses. Not everywhere, but there have been glitches. Can the system handle this?
We're going to find out. Some days I don't think so, like today here in Virginia with that cut cable. Of all the days for the system to shut down, the last day to register to vote, it makes you wonder, are these things really accidents? Or, as many people have emailed me today, were they intentional in some fashion? I don't think they were intentional. But, you know, Shep, this is because, first of all, the system wasn't built to handle maybe half the vote being cast ahead of Election Day. It also is partly a result of partisans deciding that certain voting methods favor them, and they want to minimize the methods that don't favor them. That leads to voter suppression. Hmm.
Look at Texas and Georgia and elsewhere. Help our viewers understand the facts about what's happening there.
Well, let's take Texas, for example. I try to be as kind as I can be, but I have got to say that the decision by Governor Abbott in Texas to limit the vote drop-off boxes to one per county, when some counties have very little population, and Harris County, the Houston area, has millions of people, as you mentioned. One drop box for votes. Isn't it obvious? Harris County, Houston, is a Democratic area. It'll produce a big margin for Democrats, assuming people are actually able to vote.
So you're talking voter suppression.
Absolutely. That is voter suppression. Nobody is going to prove otherwise. That is voter suppression, underlined 10 times.
Given all that we've heard, what should voters expect, Larry, on election night?
Given that a good piece of the voting will be done ahead of time, but can't be opened in many states until the polls close at 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. or whenever they close locally, you're going to have all of those paper ballots first taken out of the envelopes in some states. Others will have already done that, but then count it, you know, sent through a machine. Maybe partisans will want to double check. There's simply no way to do it quickly when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of ballots in some states, millions and millions across the country. So people who want an election night need to remember that if there's not a landslide, then you're talking about election week. And let's just all pray it doesn't go beyond a week.
In absence of a landslide, as you put it, what are your concerns about how candidates may react?
Oh, I'm very concerned, particularly, to be honest, about President Trump at the national level and some state candidates who are going to take the voting day, November 3rd voting, which will probably be released first in most states, and use that to claim victory when, in fact, the Election Day vote is going to be very substantially Republican. The pre-election vote is going to be very substantially Democratic, but it won't all be counted until the next day or later in the week. So if you're a Republican candidate or you're President Trump, you go out there and declare victory, then your supporters will think that any attempt to count the other votes and to make the election go the other way is voter fraud, which is malarkey, but we all know that people are gullible.
Professor Sabato from UVA, thank you.
Thank you, Chef.
The plot to kidnap the governor of Virginia thickens, and now there's more. Brand new today, the feds say some of the same members of the anti-government paramilitary groups also considered abducting the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam. An FBI agent testified today that the suspects discussed taking the governor's because of their coronavirus lockdown orders. As we reported here, investigators say the men planned to snatch Michigan's governor from her vacation home, put her on trial for treason, and incite a civil war. Some of the suspects were there at lockdown protests in Michigan back in April when heavily armed demonstrators stormed the state Capitol building. Before those lockdown protests, President Trump tweeted, "Liberate Michigan and liberate Virginia." Today, Governor Northam said rhetoric like that needs to stop.
When language is used such as to liberate Virginia, people, they find meaning in those words, and thus these things happen, and that's regrettable.
Let's get more. NBC News investigative correspondent Tom Winter now.
Shep, that plot to kidnap the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, certainly grabbed a lot of the attention at today's hearing. And it's a detention hearing basically to figure out if they can keep the people that were involved, the six people charged in this plot to kidnap Michigan's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, if they can somehow keep them in jail, in custody, pending this trial. And we got new details today about how this investigation really started to unravel. Specifically, the June 6th meeting, which is one of these key meetings that the FBI says they were able to surveil. That happened in Dublin, Ohio, northwest of Columbus, a nice community there where people, according to the FBI agent that testified today, from four or five different states came together to meet to talk about these plots, talk about COVID-19 restrictions and their concerns and really their anger that they had towards the decisions made by governors in several states. They talked about the plot. They talked about using encrypted messaging apps, how they would use code names for each other's names on those apps, how they would change different apps, thinking that they were trying to outsmart the FBI, which, according to their testimony today, had a confidential informant that kept being moved to all those chats with them. They had a mole in their midst, and they knew nothing about it, Chip.
Tom Winter, thanks. Some movement today on the coronavirus relief bill. Congress has tried for months, apparently, to get something done. Now the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, says he's planning a vote on a stimulus bill this month, sometime after the Senate returns, obviously, on Monday. He says the plan is to include targeted relief for American workers, that's a quote, and new funding for small business loans. That's through the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP. Mitch McConnell says he'll have enough time to do that and confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Democrats, of course, could dismiss this proposal as not enough for people who need help. Right now, there's frankly no bill to see, and Democrats haven't commented on the record. COVID Watch now, two setbacks today in the fight against the deadly pandemic. One on the antibody front, the other in the race for a vaccine.
There was the adverse event.
An unexplained illness causing a key coronavirus vaccine trial to pause. What this means for the battle against COVID-19.
We cannot let ourselves remain divided.
We are more successful now than we've ever been before.
President Trump in Pennsylvania, Joe Biden in Florida. What's the status of the race just 3 weeks till the vote? Destroyed and devastated, living through Hurricane Delta, in her own words.
It's just unbelievable, but we'll rebuild.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith, back in 60 seconds.
COVID Watch, coronavirus cases rising across our nation. The United States is averaging nearly 50,000 new cases every day over the past week. That is the highest in nearly 2 months, according to Johns Hopkins. Right now, 41 states are reporting an increase in COVID cases. The states shown here in red are getting hit the hardest. Ohio, among those showing a spike in new cases. And today, Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine warned that we could have a tough winter ahead with more people moving back indoors. Dr. Anthony Fauci said the same thing when I spoke with him last night.
We have a baseline of infections now that vary between 40 and 50,000 per day. That's a bad place to be when you're going into the cooler weather of the fall and the colder weather of the winter.
Dr. Fauci said Americans need to follow the basic health protocols. Wear masks, keep distancing, and wash your hands so that we can, as he puts it, turn this around. Two bumps along the road toward a COVID vaccine or treatment today. Johnson & Johnson's the first. It paused a vaccine trial. Officials say one of its volunteers has an unexplained illness. And then this afternoon, Eli Lilly paused a trial for its antibody treatment. That company cites safety concerns. Let's turn to Meg Terrell now. What do these developments mean, and should people be concerned about them, Meg?
Well, hi, Shep. We've got very limited information on these events right now, but experts tell us, based on what we do know, even though these are moving at record paces, what these pauses show is that the system is actually putting the right safety checks in place. So let's start with Eli Lilly. We just got that information this afternoon. This company is developing antibody drugs to treat COVID-19. Now, that, of course, is the same approach that was used to treat the president, although the drug given to him was made by Regeneron. Now, Eli Lilly confirmed today that one of its antibody drug trials has been paused out of what it calls an abundance of caution to ensure the safety of the patients in the trial. But we don't know anything further right now. Now, last night, Johnson & Johnson confirmed it temporarily paused dosing in its COVID-19 vaccine trials because of an unexplained illness in a participant. And we have no more details yet there either. But Dr. Eric Topol said there's no reason yet for concern.
This means the system's working, that independent data and safety monitoring boards are reviewing the data, getting all the facts together. And it's expected. Every large clinical trial runs into these things at one point or another, pretty much.
Now, he also said it is crucial for public trust that the companies be transparent. Shep?
Meg Terrell, thanks. Remember, hospitalizations are a lagging indicator, right? Well, new today, the number of people ending up in a hospital from COVID-19 increased in 42 states over the past week. That's from Johns Hopkins. For context, we turn to Dr. Esther Chu, professor of emergency medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Chu, thank you.
Nice to be here, Shep.
Doctor, cases are spiking, hospitalizations are up, can't dispute this. Are hospitals and medical professionals prepared for the surge? Can the system handle it?
Well, there's going to be a little bit of an unknown factor here, but I think we have some good news and we have some maybe concerning news. The good news is that we spent all spring preparing for just this. We didn't know what we were getting in terms of COVID. There were some projections that had us way over baseline capacity. So we spent much of the spring and early summer building in extra capacity, oftentimes extra physical capacity, transforming our spaces so that we can accommodate many more people, and creating protocols and procedures so that we were equipped to handle all kinds of surge in patients while also keeping staff and patients safe from contracting the disease. So we're in a totally different situation than we were in the fall, in that we've invested a lot of time and resources to be prepared for almost anything. I think the issue is that we are now headed into COVID colliding with influenza, and we just can't anticipate how much extra volume those colliding viruses will cause us.
Doctor, since you mentioned that, there are some indications, correct me if I'm wrong, from South America, where flu happens at a different time of year, that all the masks and all the hand washing and all the pay attention has made flu not so bad. Could that happen here? And is that what you're seeing, or do you know yet?
We don't know it yet because flu hasn't hit us. But you're right. These things like social distancing, face mask wearing, extra hand washing, those things will actually affect any virus. So it's possible that we'll see different epidemiologic patterns this year because of what we're doing for COVID. It's way too early to tell. And of course, all these things depend on people actually doing these things. And in places where people are not as careful for COVID, I think there will not be as much of a chance that it could curb flu as well.
Well, areas have been identified across the country, some in the Pacific Northwest, some in the Midwest. There are other areas, you know them, we've talked about them. In those areas, with this combination of flu and a surge, which you and all of your colleagues are predicting in COVID-19, are you concerned about ability to handle things there?
We are concerned everywhere. And, you know, some of the things I mentioned, we have taken care of. You know, we put in a lot of protocols, a lot of policies to, and plans for surge. But I will tell you, there were some fixed resources that we haven't really managed to make a dent in. Things like personal protective equipment. We have not stopped running out of it.
You're still running out of PPP. You don't have enough masks. You don't have enough gowns. You don't have enough for hospital workers, even still.
We are still reusing and reusing things that are normally single-use items like N95 masks.
Why isn't there enough for our doctors and nurses?
It's the big question, and part of it is that these supply chains are very complicated and cannot be ramped up quickly. Part of it is that we haven't mobilized existing resources by invoking the Defense Production Act. Part of it is that there's worldwide demand since this epidemic has affected everybody. And so it's really multifactorial.
Right.
But all these months have not solved this problem.
So there's not enough. And if we don't want to have a surge and put you and your colleagues and our heroes across the nation who are frontline medical people at risk, we got to do our part, wear our stuff and wash our hands. Is that a bottom line?
That is the bottom line. The only thing we can do to allow health systems to function well and give the sickest of people the best care is to do as much as we can upstream to limit the number of people who come to us. So mask wearing, social distancing, avoiding large indoor gatherings, these have never been more crucial.
Dr. Esther Chu, it's great to see you. Thank you for your service. We'll speak with you again soon. Testing is important. It's not everything, but it's important. In China, they've tested more than 3 million people in one city, Qingdao. That's a port city south of Beijing. Out of more than 1 million tests returned, zero have come back positive. Not one. That's the report from Qingdao's health department. But Beijing says at least 6 cases were found over the last day, which, as you might imagine, raises fresh concern about China's reporting of the deadly virus. Other places, COVID is gripping Europe. Hear this, more than 566,000 cases confirmed over the past week. That's in Europe alone. And that is close to a 50% increase from the previous week. Fall surge, anyone? But despite the lockdowns, the EU is still trying to make sure people and goods can move freely in some areas, establishing red, orange, and green zones. So in green zones, where the virus infections are low, travel won't be as restrictive. In orange and red zones, tighter restrictions will remain in place. It's all kind of complicated. But here's NBC's Matt Bradley in Paris on how Europe is handling all of this.
Yeah, Sheppel, here in France, the prime minister said that the second wave is here. And that's as France saw a three-month high in the number of ICU patients with COVID. And the head of the health service even said that as early as next week, 90% of ICU beds here in Paris could be occupied with COVID patients. And that's why French authorities are considering imposing a nighttime curfew. And that decision could come as early as tomorrow. Now, in Britain, across the channel, 143 people died of COVID in the last 24 hours. That's a four-month high. And that comes as 17,000 new cases were just reported today. Now, in Italy, pickup games among friends banned, parties among more than 6 people who don't live together also banned. And that's new restriction. That's the second time in a week the Italians have imposed yet more restrictions. And, you know, none of these restrictions across Europe are popular at all, Shep. In Spain, actually, the prime minister had to impose a state of emergency to force authorities in the capital, Madrid, to accept a kind of partial lockdown on that city. And that's as cases nationwide in Spain have been rising by something around 12,000 per day. Shep?
Well, Matt Bradley from Paris. Dealing with COVID is hard, right? And the way we've dealt with it as a society, even as friends and neighbors, has left us in some cases pretty divided. There's fear and there's fatigue. And lots of people are worn out from all of it. Here's CNBC's Contessa Brewer.
The pandemic fatigue is obvious.
Yeah, here we are.
At political rallies, parties, and play dates. With infection rates on the rise, the nation's health leaders are begging Americans to avoid crowds and stay outdoors, wash hands, and wear masks.
Those simple things, as simple as they sound, can certainly turn around the spikes that we see.
There is a whole panorama of perspectives on pandemic protection, for those who are still wiping down grocery deliveries to those who refuse to alter their behavior at all. Most of us fall somewhere in the middle.
Thinking about, like, I'm in a group that does this or I'm in a group that does that doesn't necessarily describe each individual's decision day to day.
Colin Glom considers himself cautious, yet
in traveling, you kind of throwing caution to the wind a little bit.
7 months into the global pandemic, flights around the country, dinner with friends, his discipline is waning.
It's very, very difficult to live in that high stress environment to think about all the precautions you have to take and think that there's something sinister around the corner all the time that's going to get you. It really does take its toll mentally and emotionally and physically on people.
And so psychologists say people gamble, taking risks with their health and the health of others.
There's only a certain amount of stamina or, you know, diligence or kind of like helping others that can be at this elevated level that can be sustained so long to sort of run out of steam.
In the meantime, we're hearing so much noise over masks versus anti-masks. But a National Geographic poll this month shows 92% of Americans say they do wear masks when leaving their house. 74% say they always do. And that's a 25% increase since July, although, of course, those high-profile videos on social media of the anti-mask versus masks grab our attention, Shep.
They certainly do. Condessa Brewer, thanks so much. Judge Amy Coney Barrett, second day on Capitol Hill, questioned on women's rights, white supremacy, and deciding the election in the courts. And next, how she answered a major question on the Affordable Care Act. Plus, we'll revisit Lake Charles and the aftermath of Hurricane Laura and most recently Hurricane Delta. We've been checking in on Wendy Harper these last few days, a victim amid the chaos, a hero around town. And her story is next. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour. Time for the top of the news. A major ruling, late breaking today from the U.S. Supreme Court. Here it is. The Trump administration can shut down the census count ahead of schedule. The result? The Census Bureau can send its findings, not including undocumented immigrants, by the end of the year. Here's the backstory. The pandemic slowed down the census work, so it reported it would finish counting by the end of this month and submit all the work next April. That's past the deadline, the one set by statute. The Trump administration asked for a change, and the Supreme Court ruled it proper. This matters because if you exclude undocumented immigrants, they don't get counted. And Republicans see that as a win for them. No jurist signatures or reasons for their actions today, which is normal in a case like this. But Justice Sonia Sotomayor did dissent and said the harms associated with an inaccurate census are avoidable and intolerable. We'll have a new Supreme Court, barring something unforeseen. It's day two of confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. The hearing is still underway. Started at 9 o'clock this morning. They took a break in the afternoon. Now they're back at it. And for the first time, here's a live picture. Senators get to question her. Republicans are all in. For Democrats, there are two main topics today: health care and women's right to choose. On Affordable Care Act, Democratic senators say Barrett's confirmation will put a lot of Americans' health insurance under threat. And on women's reproductive rights, they say Barrett on the court means Roe v. Wade will be overturned. CNBC's Elon Moy now. Elon, what, if anything, did Judge Barrett reveal about her views on those two particular issues?
Well, Shep, Barrett tried to channel the woman that she would replace on the bench, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who famously said that an impartial judge gives no hint or forecast in any case, no matter what the issue may be.
Judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process.
Well, that didn't stop senators from trying to pin her down. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments over the Affordable Care Act just 1 week after the election. And Barrett said she's not on a mission to destroy the law, and she swatted away speculation that the White House had asked her to commit to a position.
If confirmed, is your goal repealing the Affordable Care Act?
Absolutely not. I was never asked, and if I had been, that would have been a short conversation.
Speaking of the election, Barrett would not say if she would recuse herself if the vote on November 3rd were contested, but she swore to put the law above politics.
I certainly hope that all members of the committee have more confidence in my integrity than to think that I would allow myself to be used as a pawn to decide this election for the American people.
Now, Barrett needed no notes as she fielded questions from senators for more than 10 hours. And Shep, they'll be back at it again tomorrow.
Elon, thanks. People in southwest Louisiana are slowly picking up the pieces from the devastation of hurricanes Laura and then Delta last week. Tonight, we check in with a woman from Lake Charles named Wendy Harper. You may remember her. We brought you her story just last week. Owner of a home health business, 50 workers who helped sick and elderly. Now her business is ruined, like so much of the region. Here she is again tonight, in her own words.
It's just been a struggle. It truly, you know, it's the next day, you're just saying, what happened? You know, how could these two storms happen within 6 weeks of each other and 13 miles apart? You know, it's just unbelievable. FEMA assistance is very, very slow to come in. That's been a huge challenge since Laura. Majority of it is done electronically. And you can call and stay on the phone on hold for 2 hours, but they're still going to ask for that documentation to be submitted. Well, we didn't have power for 23 days. We still don't have internet at the office. I finally got an AT&T hotspot in, so I brought that home. We can't give them the documentation they need. It just doesn't exist right now. We get really frustrated here locally because we know if it would be New Orleans, it would be a whole different story, you know, and we kind of joke about it at times saying, okay, where's the rock stars, you know, with the charity concerts and, you know, where is all that? But it, for some reason, it doesn't tend to be as much attention on this side of the state. And we're resilient, strong people. We're going to make it happen, but it would be nice to get some assistance.
Wendy reminds us all Lake Charles had a pretty good economy before the hurricanes. Of course, they've been battered by the dip in the oil industry and the ravages of COVID-19, but surviving this is going to be tough. Wendy's biggest fear, she says, that her friends and neighbors will not return after these two evacuations. Well, pain for the airliners. Delta reports it's lost more than $11 billion in this pandemic. And that's what's topping CNBC on the money. Delta reports revenue is down 75% from last year. 18,000 of its employees have accepted buyouts or early retirement as the company cut costs. But executives say they have some hope for the future. They're now predicting sales may not return to where they were for another 2 years or more, but they are encouraged by interest in travel around Thanksgiving and Christmas. If we're not flying, apparently we're buying sofas. Ethan Allen reports sales are booming. The stock popped today, and the company now expects to be profitable at least this quarter. And blast off for Blue Origin, the first of 2020 for the space company founded by Jeff Bezos. They call it the New Shepard. Same spelling, no relation. It successfully took off this morning from a desert launch pad in West Texas. Blue Origin said it traveled 66 miles way up into the air. And both the rocket and the crew capsule returned safely to Earth, but of course no astronauts on board. The payload did include tests for a future lunar exploration. On Wall Street, a win streak snapped. Stocks finished lower for the first time in 5 days. The Dow lower by 158. The S&P down 0.6%. The Nasdaq doing the best, down just 0.1%. The lockdown trade returned. Financials, industrials, and energy stocks all struggled. Consumer stocks and tech held their ground. The president is dividing the country. That's what Joe Biden says in an interview we're about to show you. Except the president he's talking about isn't the current one. And a giant explosion underwater. Pretty cool, right? Wait till you see what caused that.
The facts. The truth. The news with Shepard Smith. Back in 90 seconds.
You've probably heard about Frost Nixon, right? The famous interview from 1977. But have you heard about Frost Biden? It did happen. The year was 1987. The legendary journalist Sir David Frost interviewed Joe Biden himself. Biden was a senator back then, making his first bid for president. It didn't last long. and the film never aired. But Frost's son is CNBC's own Wilfred Frost, and he's making his dad's interview public for the first time. Here's Sir David Frost asking Joe Biden what Americans need. As the Reagan years came to an end, his answer might sound familiar.
There was a time when the slogan was that what the American people needed was a chicken in every pot, or then maybe a car in every garage, or a home for every family. What do they need now?
A reestablished sense of community, a sense of shared obligations and aspirations, a solid dose of idealism mixed with their newfound realism, a sense of that kind of optimism we've had before that has always been the past, been mingled with a sense of commitment to one another. This president, the thing that I disagree with him most about is the way he has divided this nation in terms of making it legitimate from one section of the country to say, let's just worry about us and not the rest.
Joe Biden, 33 years ago, Wilfred Frost with us now. Wilf, he looked a little different, but if you just listen, what he's saying to your dad sounds like, well, could have been today.
It really could have been today, couldn't it? And that theme kind of comes through the rest of the interview. There's even a bit, Shep, where they talk about the size of the deficit and which taxes to increase to pay it off. But I've saved that particular clip for Sarah and Closing Bell tomorrow. But I think the standout thing of this interview, it was classic David Frost, classic dad, a long-form, over two-hour interview, wow, exploring someone's personal philosophy. And the answers, therefore, are kind of timeless, whether they were recorded 30 years ago or today.
Yeah, it never aired, as I mentioned. Why is that?
Well, so Dad did a show back then ahead of the 88 election called The Next President with David Frost. All 12 candidates, he interviewed six Dems and six Republicans. Only 11 went out because Biden, as you said at the top, pulled out just weeks after that was recorded. And because it never aired, the only copy of the tape was the master tape, and it very nearly got thrown out. It was found in a storage depot in Cleveland that I never knew about immediately after Dad passed away.
What a vault of material, and you can hear the full interview and many others on the Frost Tapes podcast. That's available tomorrow wherever you get your podcast. Wilf, thanks so much. A soccer superstar tests positive for COVID, and a big bomb explodes in Poland as we go around the world in 80 seconds. Poland, the biggest World War II bomb found in the country, explodes underwater. It happened as Navy divers tried to defuse it. The bomb found in this small town in the northwestern part of the country. People across the region said they felt the shockwaves. The explosive device weighed 12,000 pounds. The earthquake bomb, they call it. During the war, the British used it to sink a Nazi battleship. India, the worst air quality since February recorded in New Delhi. There's a haze that's getting thicker and engulfing the region and leaving the sky an orange color. Pollution, a yearly problem here. Experts warn the increased pollution levels could be hazardous to COVID patients. Portugal, soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo testing positive for COVID-19. That's according to the Portuguese Soccer Federation. Officials say Ronaldo is doing well and has no symptoms, and that he will not be playing in tomorrow's match against Sweden. Peru, some people wait hours to visit Machu Picchu. But for this Japanese tourist, it took 7 months. Jesse Takayama has been stuck in Peru because of COVID travel restrictions. The country finally granting him the opportunity to see the Incan ruins all by himself.
Amazing, thank you.
Better late than never, as we go around the world in 80 seconds. Fans in the stands. For the first time since March, some baseball players enjoyed some real crowd noise when thousands of people went to a ballpark in Texas. Plus a six-minute-long encounter with a cougar. See this? The man in this video here survived, and he's live with us. The story of Man versus Wild next. Thursday night football. Not something you hear a lot, but tonight it's a thing. A source telling the Associated Press the Tennessee Titans reported no new positive COVID test, which gives Tennessee the green light to host the undefeated Buffalo Bills. The last time the NFL played a game on Tuesday night was back in 2010 when a blizzard delayed an Eagles-Vikings game, but it's rare. Tonight's comes as the NFL ramps up its COVID testing. According to new reports, get this, the league's going to start testing teams every single day, even on game days. Now, baseball and fans back in the stands last night for the first time at any game this season. Happened in Arlington during game one of the NLCS, Braves and Dodgers. According to MLB, there are limits, but more than 10,000 people showed up for this game. Those fans all spread out around the park, and from our cameras, it looks like, you know, they're mostly wearing masks. The league announced it will let some fans inside the stadium when the World Series kicks off next week, but those tickets are already sold out. A heartwarming way to help kids in North Philadelphia stay off the street, and a heart-stopping video of a cougar stalking a man when we go coast to coast. Indiana. A 5-year-old boy jumps to defend his mom when 4 men break into their house. Cops say it went down like this. 3 of the men who broke in all had guns. The boy fought back, threw a toy, and swung at them before they left. Cops still looking for the suspect. California. Police say they chased a U-Haul through several Southern California cities last night.
Here's going to hit that car. Oh, man.
They say the suspected stolen truck crashed into cars and got stuck on curbs, even lost a tire. The chase finally ended in a Long Beach park. Pennsylvania. Boxing lessons for North Philly kids outside the 22nd Police District. Its captain leads the classes twice a week. He calls it guns down, gloves up.
I wanted to do something different from a community relations standpoint that connected to what's the core reason of why violence happens. And it's emotions, anger.
And he says he's already noticed crime go down when the practice is in session. Utah.
No, go away.
Watch a cougar stalk and lunge at this guy.
No.
He says he walked near its cubs on a hiking trail, so Mama Cougar began jumping at him, paws flaring and hissing.
No!
He says he tried to fight her off by yelling and throwing rocks.
I don't feel like dying today.
He says one of the rocks finally hit her and she ran off. And that's a CNBC trip, coast to coast. So you caught that last one, right? Unwelcome guest joining a man on a jog in Utah. Look here again, look.
No, go away! Go away! No.
Holy.
No. You, dude. Holy. No, go away.
Yeah, go away is right.
Go
that
away.
Man on the trail there is Kyle Burgess. No. He's alive and well, and he's with us on Zoom. What was that like, Kyle?
It was insane. It was something I was not expecting. I just wanted to go on my run, get my exercise in for the weekend. But obviously it ended very differently. Yeah.
So she had to have been just protecting the cubs, right? Because I figure if she wanted you dead, you'd be dead.
No, that's exactly right. I just made a mistake, I guess, and came up on those cubs, not really knowing what they were. I kind of thought they were bobcats because I had seen bobcats on the trail before. And so just pull my phone out. Let's get some cool pictures of the bobcats because they really don't do too much.
How'd you come up with, go away? Where'd you get that genius?
It's just, maybe just instinct or just something to say to make me feel loud and big, maybe. I don't know.
Right. So in the middle, you're all amped up and everything. When it was over, did you have like a reality check? Whoa.
Yeah, really like, kind of like touch my legs, touch my arms. I was like, oh, okay, everything's here. That just happened. Like it was so surreal that it actually happened.
Had to be. How many rocks did you throw, do you know?
I only threw one. It was at the very end. Every other time I bent down to try to get a rock, it either pounced at me or took a lunge forward.
Be careful out there.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Hey, did you see the new iPhone yet? It's here. We'll show it to you. Worth the hype? Well, it's faster speeds, bigger camera, sleek design, and a bit of a throwback thing. It's a real, well, you be the judge. Apple's out with its latest iPhone. It's the 12. New sizes, different prices. Not just for gadget fans either. Apple knows how to make a splash. And millions are waiting to see what their next iPhone will look like and feel like. Throwback? CNBC's Josh Lipton breaks it down for us.
Ranging from $699 to $1,099, Apple revealing its newest class of iPhones with new colors available. At the low price range, the iPhone 12 mini. At the high end, the iPhone 12 Pro Max. All are 5G enabled, which promises faster data speeds for tasks like streaming music and movies. All models have bigger displays, are lighter, and are powered by a new chip that will make everything on your iPhone feel faster. It also boasts an advanced camera system, always a big selling point to consumers. But what's missing with these? Headphones and a power adapter won't come included because Apple says that's going to help its supply chain move closer to being carbon neutral by 2030. Apple CEO Tim Cook touting this as the biggest change to the iPhone in years.
Every decade, there's a new generation of technology that provides a step change in what we can do with our iPhones. The next generation is here. Today is the beginning of a new era for iPhone.
But does it justify the price tag? Right now, 5G coverage in the U.S. is still spotty. While it's available in some major cities, it's not consistent across the country. Transitioning to this technology is complex, and the road has been bumpy. Sometimes people talk about the age of America's cars on the road, but what about the age of our iPhones? By next year, an estimated 420 million iPhones out in the wild will be at least 3 years old. So the key question here, how many of those users are now going to feel like it's high time for an upgrade?
That's a good question. Josh, what's old is new again. Look at this. On the left, we're going to show you, that's the old iPhone 4. See that? With those flat edges, and it kind of feels like a harsh corner around the end. That came out 10 years ago. The iPhone, they're touting this new version that looks just like that is new again.
So you are right. So the design is being described by some as a throwback with these sort of flat edges. Another shift here is Apple's really touting how tough these phones are. Tough in terms of their glass specifically. Listen, Apple knows we drop these phones a lot, so they're trying to make them more durable. That durability can be another selling point for consumership.
What can that phone do that my brand new CNBC phone cannot do?
Well, Shep, I don't know what phone CNBC has been generous enough to give you.
It's the good one.
There are a few features, though, with this phone. I don't doubt it.
Go on.
There's a few different features. One, this phone is won by their greatest and latest chip. That's going to mean that phone should feel like it's a lot faster. Also, a new camera system. Now, that whenever you take a survey, Shep, you ask people.
Another new camera system? We just got a new camera system.
A new camera system. It always ranks very high up there because people really do want those better photos and those better videos. And, of course, the big headline here, those phones are 5G enabled, Shep.
Yeah, but we don't have the systems, the 5G systems across the country to. But you talk about the phone. Is it going to be as good as an Android? Because everybody says the Android is better. I like the iPhone, but I don't know. I don't own Stockton anything, so whatever.
Shep, we'll have to take a poll when these phones come out. I would ask viewers, keep an eye on CNBC's Todd Hazelton. That is our crackerjack tech reviewer. Apple made a lot of big claims today. Let's let Todd take these bad boys for a test drive and see what he thinks. And then, Shep, report back to you, make a decision.
Todd, thanks. I guarantee you there will be more on Squawk Box bright and early on CNBC tomorrow morning. Thank you. 50 seconds on a race to the finish now. An experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19 hitting a snag. The drug company Eli Lilly pausing its trial because of a potential safety concern. This comes one day after drug maker Johnson & Johnson paused its vaccine trial because a volunteer came down with an unexplained illness. Record-smashing voter turnout continuing across our nation. Long lines in Texas where early in-person voting started just today. Some voters said they had to wait for hours. And the top Republican in the United States Senate, the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, says senators will vote on a stripped-down coronavirus relief bill next week, but he needs support from Democrats in the House, and they've already signaled it's nowhere near enough money. And now you know the news. For this Tuesday, October the 13th, 2020, I'm Shepard Smith. See you back here tomorrow. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.